Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Kast. Thanks for joining us. Today we're talking about a practice that originated in medieval England, but is part of our criminal justice system today, bail. In simplest form, bail is money promised or paid to a court with the understanding that upon release, the accused person will either return for trial or forfeit the bail. Supporters of the system say it keeps defendants honest, making it more likely they'll appear for court dates, while high bails keep those who might endanger public safety locked up until they are tried. Critics disagree. They say the bail system allows those with money to buy their way out of jail, whether or not they're guilty. Meanwhile, poor defendants may remain behind bars awaiting trial for months, sometimes even years. The bail reform movement dates back to the 1960s, but change has been slow to come. Washington, D.C. eliminated cash bail 2 decades ago, but only a few states have begun to follow suit. Maryland's highest court, the Court of Appeals, ruled in 2013 that all defendants have a right to counsel at their initial hearing when bail is set, a major change to the system. Since then, 2 state panels have made recommendations about the bail system. Both recommended eliminating money bail. But bail reform has made little progress in the legislature. A new report from the Able Foundation contends that progress is possible even without changing the laws governing bail, titled Finishing the Job, Modernizing Maryland's Bail System. The report lays out short and long-term goals for bail reform in Maryland. Later in the hour, we'll hear from Paul DeWolf, the public defender of Maryland, as well as Scott Schellenberger, state's attorney for Baltimore County. But first, Charisse Fano-Burdine, executive director of the Pretrial Institute, is with me here in the studio. The Pretrial Institute wrote the Able Foundation report. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you.
The legislature passed some sweeping reforms of criminal justice this year. Reforms really sort of focused on ways to do justice smarter and cheaper, to not to spend more in it, but to reinvest and change the way money's spent. Bail reform wasn't part of that. Why not?
So the justice reinvestment process that Maryland undertook should be commended, and I'm really proud of the work of that statewide committee as well as some of the legislative outcomes of that. That was focused on state prisoners and sentencing reform for the most part. And so pretrial and the role of our jails here in Maryland was not part of that commission, but I'm certainly hopeful that that team will stay together and now turn their attention to bail reform.
But the numbers are huge. I mean, the numbers of people who end up behind bars in jail, it's like half the number of those who are actually behind bars in prison in Maryland.
Yes, ma'am. We like to say that pretrial detention is really the gateway to mass incarceration, and you'll have more residents of Maryland in jails in Maryland than you ever will have going to state prison.
So you said you're hopeful.
I am hopeful.
Why? Based on what?
Well, based on my eternal optimism, of course, but really I served on both commissions under Governor O'Malley to look at pretrial reform statewide. And we entitled this report Finishing the Job because bail reform and pretrial justice reform really is the lowest hanging fruit on the criminal justice reform tree. We have both the law and the science ready to go to implement the change that's needed. These are really common sense solutions, and Maryland can do this quickly. It'll save money, it'll improve public safety, and it'll actually improve, I believe, the way in which the police and the community interact.
The law and the science.
Yes, ma'am.
A lot of people are thinking, what science when we're talking about courts?
Great. And that's a good distinction. So I'm not talking about science or evidence like you have when you're talking about evidence in a case. I'm talking about the science behind how can we predict whether somebody is likely to come back to court or stay arrest-free pending trial. And that science is a pretrial risk assessment instrument. It's been used for decades in other jurisdictions.
I got to stop you on the word
instrument
because most of us use instrument to refer to something like a computer or, you know, scissors. I mean, what is an instrument when you're talking about risk assessment?
So a pretrial risk assessment instrument or a pretrial risk assessment tool is really nothing more than practically a single sheet of paper with about 7 to 9 questions that take the data from somebody's criminal case filing, criminal history, their things about them, and weights those items and produces a score, much like we have risk assessment in when I get car insurance. They do an assessment to predict my likelihood of getting in an accident, and that's how they determine how to handle me.
Let me ask listeners to hold that thought in their heads while I ask you. Let's talk about the process as it works now. If I'm arrested for a crime in Maryland, what happens?
If you're arrested for a crime, the first point of contact with the court system will be the district court commissioners in Maryland. And those folks review the probable cause arrest, and they look at your criminal history, and they set bail initially here in Maryland. About half the time, folks are released with a promise that they will make their court appearance, and about half the time they're...
So let me just make sure I'm understanding that. So about half the time, defendant doesn't have to come up with any money. They just say, I will come back. I will come back for my court date.
Correct. Now, the problem with that first stage is that we're not doing that based on risk in Maryland. We're doing that almost solely based on charge.
On charge?
Yes, ma'am.
Which means?
Which means you could have a person arrested for a low-level misdemeanor charge in Maryland with a very lengthy criminal history. And it's not clear at this point, because the district court commissioners do not use a pretrial risk assessment instrument or tool, that that we're experiencing, we don't know of the 50% of people who are released on their own recognizant. We have no sense of the risk profile of those individuals. So you could have very dangerous people charged with low-level offenses being released right at that moment.
So when you say that mostly it's based on charge, it's the charge... Just the new charge.
The new charge, the charge for which you have just been arrested.
Arrested. And does the commissioner even know what your criminal history is?
Yes. In Maryland, they do have access to that information. But again, it's not clear how much of that information is involved in the decision-making process, because we don't use what science shows helps our discretionary decision-making, which is this risk tool.
We saw some wide variations in bails set for those arrested after Freddie Gray's funeral in the rioting and unrest that afternoon and evening. For example, Alan Bullock, the teenager who was photographed smashing the windshield of a police cruiser with a traffic cone, got bail of $500,000, $500,000. Officer Cesar Goodson, who is set to go on trial this week for charges including depraved heart murder, is free on bail of $350,000, so only about two-thirds. Is the amount of bail entirely up to a judge's discretion?
Yes, the amount of bail is typically up to the discretion of a judge. But I would point out in this case and many other cases across Maryland, there are ranges associated with offenses. So there's typically a range in which a judge will set that bail. But you can just get a sense of the arbitrary nature of the dollar amount, because there really is no science that supports that $250,000 is the, quote, right amount, or that $350,000 is the right amount. These are all arbitrary amounts of money that we're picking. I would also point out that there's great disparity in the way in which Marylanders are able to make those bail amounts. And so, for example, that young man who had the $500,000 bail set, it took his family some time to come up with that money, whereas the officers were able to bond out almost immediately.
Because they had a different network of support, a different set of...
They had different access to different amounts of resources that could be brought to bear on those things. And the report that we issued shows there's great disparity in bail setting, both from a economic status and a racial status here in Maryland.
This is Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Charisse Fano-Burdeen, Executive Director of the Pretrial Justice Institute. We're talking about the bail system in Maryland and the prospects for reform. Do you have experience with the bail system? Do you think making defendants pay something to stay out of jail is a good way of ensuring they'll show up for trial? You can call us at 410-662-8780 or email midday@wypr.org. You talked about variations in bail. I believe I read in your report that is it the amounts that are five times heavier in Baltimore than in Montgomery County? There was some variation fivefold between Baltimore and Montgomery County.
So in the report, and specifically focused on Baltimore neighborhoods, we looked to see what the average median income was for Baltimoreans, as well as the average amount of bond set, in particular with low-risk defendants, who are the safest bet for coming back to court and staying arrest-free. What we found is that the average median income is about $26,000 in those neighborhoods in Baltimore, but the average bail amount was $51,000 for low-risk defendants. So that's twice the amount that we found in Prince George's County and five times the amount of bail set in Montgomery County. So this is really where justice by geography comes into play.
And what Well, first of all, you confused me a minute ago because you referred to low-risk defendants.
Yes.
But I thought you had told us that in Maryland we're not using a formal assessment of risk.
Statewide, you are not. There are 24 jurisdictions in Maryland, 24 counties. Only five of them even have an agency within the government to do assessment or supervision of defendants. But only two of those programs are using tools that have been validated, meaning that we know that they are predicting whether or not people are going to come back to court and stay arrest-free pending trial. And Baltimore happens to be one where we do actually have a pretrial risk assessment instrument.
So we actually know.
We know the risk level.
Who is a low-risk defendant? Who's a higher-risk defendant? Is that used in setting bails?
It is. So it is. It's information that is known, but I would suggest that it is not driving the decision-making. If you can take low-risk defendants as the example with a $51,000 financial condition set upon them, I'm not sure what that proves. I'm not sure what that outcome is trying to intend. What we know is that if you keep low-risk people in jail anything over just a couple of days, their outcomes are worse. So even if they're able to pull that money together, and most are not, about two-thirds of those people will stay detained pending trial.
When you say their outcomes are worse,
yes.
What do you mean?
So research has demonstrated that after just a few days in jail, a low-risk defendant, holding everything else constant, once they are able to get out of jail, they are more likely to fail to appear in court and more likely to be rearrested, both in the short term and as long as 2 years later.
And this is even the ones who showed up as low-risk on the assessment.
This is ones who show up as low risk. And it's a correlation. And what we think is driving this is that in the first couple of days, the three things that we know are stabilizing factors in people's lives, all people, are connections to family, stable housing, and employment. And for lower income individuals, in particular, that's who we arrest and put in jail in this country, we know that in the first couple of days, they're likely to lose those jobs, their housing situation becomes tenuous, and their family structure can be deeply affected by being gone just a few days.
So you're saying essentially that as you see it, the current bail system is not just unfair or inefficient, it's counterproductive.
It's actually counterproductive, yes.
What do you think you have brought forth in this report that people didn't already know? Do you really think you've changed the discussion?
Well, what we hope we've contributed to with this report is to build on the collaborative work of the Justice Reinvestment Team that worked so hard over the last year to put forward the legislation that was recently passed. We hope to provide a pathway to reform. In the governor's commissions, we did issue recommendations, but we were not able to put forward a pathway to reform. And so we think really now with this report, there are some clear short-term, medium-term, and long-term goals that, again, from our perspective, are within incredible reach of the existing structure under the governor's office to really move this forward. There's also a lot of space for the judiciary to make change now without having to go through legislation.
I want to ask you about those, about your recommendations, but we do need to take a quick break here. And when we come back, more on Maryland's bail system and calls for reform, we'll talk to a prosecutor and a public defender, and we'll speak with you if you phone us at 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email, midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the bail system and what advocates say needs changing. Charisse Fano-Burdeen, Executive Director of the Pretrial Justice Institute, is with us. And two more guests have joined us. Paul DeWolf, who heads the Office of the Public Defender in Maryland, is with me in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Baltimore County State's Attorney Scott Schellenberger has joined us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. Hello, Charisse. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Scott.
Hello, Scott.
Okay, so everybody knows everybody. I want to pick up something that you probably all have ideas about also that I read in the ABLE report that we're discussing, and also a lot of journalism on this issue. Defendants who can't make bail sometimes plead guilty. Reform advocates contend they often feel pressured to plead guilty when they don't think they are. Paul DeWolf, as a public defender, what do you observe? Does that happen, and is it widespread or de minimis?
No, it absolutely does happen, and I think there have been recent studies that show that pretrial detention adds to the amount of jail time or adds to the conviction rate of individuals that are arrested. So if someone is arrested and released to their home, for example, and they show up for court, studies have shown that they're less likely to be convicted than those that are detained. And I think a lot of that has to do with the pressure to plead guilty. Because when you're kept in these conditions, as the Baltimore City, I'm sure you've heard about the conditions in the Baltimore City Jail, there's more pressure on an individual to plead guilty just to get out of jail, rather than to force the state to go to trial.
Well,
I think that happens routinely.
Some of our listeners may think, well, if you plead guilty, you're quite likely to end up in behind bars serving a sentence.
Well, often what happens, especially with poor people and with low-level offenders, is that they're given what's called a time-served disposition. And what that means is that if you're detained for 30, 60, 90 days because you're too poor to put up money, then the state will offer you to get out of jail if you plead guilty and give you credit for the time that you've already served. That's called a time-served disposition. And that counts on someone's record as a conviction and two, a jail sentence. And so the rates of people who are, the amount of time they spend in jail is absolutely proportionate to whether or not they're detained pretrial.
Scott Schellenberger, you're a prosecutor.
Yes.
Do you think that being held pretrial, being held in jail before one's trial, increases the pleas? And if so, does the system sort of count on that? Count on not everyone going to trial?
Well, number one, every one of these individuals you're talking about is either going to have a private lawyer or one of Paul's excellent lawyers standing right next to them. And if they are standing there saying that, I didn't do this, then they're going to have every right to have a trial. When Paul talks about these low-level individuals, I can only talk about the experience I have here in Baltimore County. And in Baltimore County, we have a jail docket, which means your case comes up very quickly if you're one of these low-level individuals charged with a minor crime or a misdemeanor. And these cases come up very quick. We also have a system where our jail personnel will let us know about cases where they believe this person probably shouldn't be sitting in jail because of the bail situation. We expedite those cases also. So, look, am I going to say the system is perfect? No. Am I open to some reforms? Absolutely. I've sat on two commissions dealing with this very issue, both with Paul and Charisse, and then I just finished spending a year with the Justice Reinvestment Act, and working on that. I absolutely am an advocate for risk assessments. They need to be validated. They need to be validated in the state of Maryland because I think we have some unique crime issues that a tool has to be devoted towards. Do I think there are some other reforms that are in the ABLE report that are very worthy of taking a look at? Absolutely. But I don't think people are pleading guilty to any major crimes And when they do plead guilty to the minor crimes, they have a very good lawyer standing right next to them.
I guess I'm confused about your point about yes, of course, with a good lawyer standing next to them, if they want to fight these charges, they have every right to go to trial. But how quick will that be?
Well, in Baltimore County, on low-level crimes, our jail docket comes up in 5 weeks. And sometimes we go a little bit faster than that. Now, certainly, I understand 5 weeks, and I listened to Charisse's argument, and I read her study about, you know, even a few days can mess up some of these folks. I understand that. But I don't think a lot of people are pleading guilty that aren't guilty of their crimes.
Paul DeWolf, you're a public defender. What does that first of all, is Baltimore, you have a view of the whole state, is Baltimore County a lot more efficient getting people to trial?
Scott would know better the average time, but in the state of Maryland, I think across the board, it's probably 30 to 60 days for district court for minor, for misdemeanor offenses. With respect to felonies, it varies across the board, and it's usually a much longer period of time. But I wanted to point out something that was in the Able Foundation report that I think is validated by my experience as a public defender in Maryland, and that is they point out that those that are detained pretrial have a 30% higher conviction rate. In other words, 30% more people are convicted, comparing those that are held pretrial and those that are released.
Okay, so you've moved us. We're not talking about pleas now.
No, we are.
It's trial and pleas.
Including
both.
Pleas, but if you're a defendant, what's important to you is a conviction. If the cases are resolved without conviction, your life is different for the rest of your life than if you're convicted. And what I found interesting, and it is sort of borne out by my experience in Maryland, that the fact that someone is held pretrial increases their risk of having that life-altering conviction by 30%. That's extremely significant.
Scott Schellenberger, when I hear Paul DeWolf say that, wouldn't I just think, well, that proves that we're probably doing a pretty good job of keeping behind bars the risky folks, the guilty folks who should be kept behind bars.
I think that's true. And remember, Paul's statistics doesn't deal just with the low-level crimes. It deals with all of the crimes. And one of the things a judge is allowed to take into account when deciding what bail to set is the severity of the crime, and also they take into account the nature of the proof against the defendant. I've heard judges say, you know, this is a really serious case, and boy, this state's got a really good case against you, and therefore the bail amount goes higher, because if you don't, you have more of an incentive after hearing that to not appear in court and show up for your trial.
Charisse is shaking her head.
Of course, love for Scott.
But you disagree with him?
Yeah, I do. I disagree.
The statistics that Paul DeWolf cited, that people held without bail are more 30% more likely to end up being guilty, judged guilty.
Yeah, so that statistic is simply confirming research we've had for decades. Probably 50 years ago, we started producing research that shows that holding everything else constant, the mere fact that someone is held in pretrial detention, they are more likely to be convicted than the exact same kind of person with the same charge and same criminal history who comes to court that day in street clothes with their family. And so this is not surprising to me in Maryland. But here's what I would suggest, too, based on your comment, Sheila, about aren't we keeping in jail the right people? We don't actually know the answer to that in Maryland, and that's what's part of the report. Because we do not know statewide the risk profile of the people that we are detaining, we can't say for certain that the 100% of the people who remain in jail pre-trial are those that should. What we actually know from national research is that half the time, the people that are the most dangerous are using the loophole of the money bail system to get out of jail pre-trial unsupervised. And my colleagues who are public defenders know that there are very few people who should not be out pre-trial. And those are the folks we should be trying to identify and detain.
That is Charisse Fano-Burdeen, Executive Director of the Pretrial Justice Institute, which just issued a report calling for bail reform. This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with me here in the studio is Maryland Public Defender Paul DeWolf, and with us on the phone is Baltimore County State's Attorney Scott Schellenberger. Join our conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wipr.org. Scott Schellenberger, it seems to me then that you are saying that money bail actually does protect public safety.
Well, what I'm saying is I think for the most part, the people in our detention centers are the right people who are sitting there waiting pretrial. Do I think that a number of the suggestions that the ABLE Foundation came up with are good ones? Absolutely. And Paul and Charisse both know. I totally agree with the risk assessment, a validated assessment tool. Totally agree that we need pretrial services unit all over the state. Totally agree that there needs to be more uniformity throughout the state. Absolutely agree with Charisse's last statement, and that is if we want to know who is in our detention centers right at this moment today, we have to make 24 phone calls, and that doesn't make any sense in this day and age. So there should be a statewide system so we can figure out who are in our jails. But what I do say is that I also think money bail still has a role to play in Maryland. You know, there's something to be said for a defendant who gets out on bail, whose grandmother or mother or father put up a certain amount for a bail bondsman. They have skin in the game, and they know that their parent or grandparent will lose money if they don't show up for court. The other thing that people forget is that when people don't show up for court, particularly for some of the low-level crimes, nobody's out looking for them except the bail bondsman. The bail bondsman has every right to go out and look for them because the bail bondsman has skin in the game. He will lose more money unless he brings that defendant to court. And that's a very important function, including if he flees the state and we have to extradite the person back. We can hold the bail bondsman responsible for those costs, and we do that on a regular basis in Baltimore County. So there are things connected to the bail system that a lot of people don't think about because they're not a direct link to just getting out of jail.
Paul DeWolf.
Yeah, I'd really like to respond to so many of Scott's points, but let me start this way. The bail system divides people into two groups, those that have resources and those that don't. In the public defender's office, we represent poor people. We represent people that don't have resources to buy their way out of court. And so when we look
at jail.
Out of jail. I'm sorry. And so when we look at the who's in the detention center, are the right people in the detention center? Yes, we should be using validated risk assessment. We should be using evidence-based practices. But as long as we perpetuate the money bail system, skin in the game means that people have resources to buy their way out of jail. My clients, the clients of the public defender's office, are poor, and so they sit. And they sit in cages that are decrepit and horrible. And if they had $1,000, if they had $500, they would be able to buy their freedom, to work with their attorneys, to live with their family, to raise their children, to go to their jobs, but they can't because they're poor. And the only one that profits from this system is the bail bond industry. The skin in the game argument means that people profit, the bail industry profits from poor people. That's what the skin in the game argument means.
Let me clarify something that I should have let Charisse address. I short-circuited when I asked you, what happens if I'm arrested for a crime? Somebody posts bail. Do they get that back?
No, they don't.
If their charges are dropped or if they're found not guilty?
No. So in the current system, most predominant use of bail money bond in Maryland, like many other states, is the commercial surety industry. And so if the court set a $10,000 bond, for example, the defendant has to come up with $1,000 to pay a bondsman who will promise that if that person doesn't show up for court, they will pay. I want to make a side note that in Maryland, like every other state in the union, money bail may not be used for public safety. It can only be used for appearance in court. So Sheila, if you got arrested and you failed to appear in court, then you would have to forfeit your bond. But if you got rearrested on a new charge, the bondsman does not have to pay that bond because you were rearrested on a new charge. Not that you failed. You didn't fail to appear. So it can't be used for public safety. So this notion that we're setting high bails because we're trying to protect the public, I'm not sure how that connection is even possible. But you don't get that money back. So if you are acquitted of those charges, you still owe that bondsman the $1,000. And most poor people enter into or are forced to enter into financial agreements with bondsmen where they're paying a little bit of that bond at a time. So you could have a debt to a bondsman that you owe long after either your court case was dropped or you've satisfied the charges and the punishment by the court.
Robert Embry, who is president of the Able Foundation, which issued this report that we're talking about in an op-ed in The Sun yesterday. Now I'm not looking for the now I'm not finding the particular thing I wanted to cite. He cited a number of the amount of money that he cited the millions of dollars that bail has taken out of family budgets, but I'm not finding it quickly. Maybe somebody will let us know. Tom has called us from Baltimore. Tom, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Tom, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to call in and share an experience specifically regarding to low-income folks and being arrested. So my brother a couple years ago was arrested for a destruction property charge. He was he's an artist, and he was actually painting a mural on a public building. He was arrested, and I believe the bail was set at about $50,000, something seemingly really, really high. So as you all just explained, that results in a $5,000 payout to a bail bondsman. Now, my friends and I and family members scraped together. We worked out the money to get him out. But by the time we did, he had lost his housing. He had lost his job. And he's now in a position where he essentially just called in a lot of favors to get that initial bail money. So I'm really curious where this notion comes from some of the people discussing that it is not a direct sort of not quite a tax, but penalty on poverty. And I to me, it seems like something that sort of creates a cycle of that it becomes then incredibly hard to get out of.
Tom, I appreciate the call. Scott Schellenberger, I know Tom was talking about a situation in the city and you're in the county, but do you have an answer for him about why this is not a penalty on the poor?
Well, first of all, Tom, thank you for your story, and I'm sorry for what happened to your brother. I think the answer is found in most of the ABLE study, and that is, you know, we should have a validated risk assessment to have done on Tom's brother. And when you then take a look at malicious destruction of property, which it would be considered a minor crime, and if his brother had no prior record and we could factor all of those factors into a risk assessment, then a judge or a commissioner would be able to make a proper assessment as to what kind of risk this individual poses. And so, you know, look, I am not here to say that the bail system in Maryland is terrific and I love it and it's great. I'm here to say that we can improve the criminal justice system by doing a number of things in the ABLE Foundation. The problem is, you know, we don't have the right kind of pretrial services supervision that you need when you want to let all of these folks out. It's easy on the low-risk people. It's easy on the high-risk people. You let the low-risk out, the high-risk you hold in. It's the middle ground
the ones who are in the middle that you have the difficult time in. And the problem there is you need a good pretrial services supervision unit to keep an eye on those people if they are out on the street. For instance,
Scott Schellenberger, we need to take a short break. Let's pick up at exactly that point when we come back. And we'll have more callers, presumably, who want to be in this conversation at 410-662-8780 or with an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about bail reform and the debate over what's needed in Maryland. I'm speaking with Charisse Fano-Burdeen, Executive Director of the Pretrial Institute, Maryland Public Defender Paul DeWolf, and Scott Schellenberger, State's Attorney for Baltimore County. Scott Schellenberger, you had raised the issue of whether we have sufficient pretrial supervision, and I just want to throw at you this question, since it costs something like $100 a day or more to hold the taxpayers pay to hold someone in pretrial supervision. Would it be possible in the line of justice reinvestment? Would it be possible to shift the resources we're already spending to have better pretrial supervision of people who are not held behind bars awaiting trial?
Absolutely. I think that's a terrific idea. We have a pretrial unit in our county. I think it works very well. I think they do a really good job. And I think there are a number of people who get out on the street because there is a good pretrial unit. The gold standard that I saw on one of the commissions that I sat on was Washington, D.C. They have a phenomenal pretrial services unit where you get drug treatment, you get moved into drug testing to make sure, you know, that you're staying clean, you're reporting to an agent all the time. The problem is, my recollection is, that program is north of $60 million for a population roughly the size of Baltimore City. I mean, we would have to multiply that by 8 or 10 times to cover the entire state. So the question is, you know, would we be able to shift enough dollars out of all of these detention centers and put into a really good, well-run pretrial services unit? And amplified on top of that is each of the local detention centers are funded and paid for by their own county. So, you know, there are a lot of great solutions out there. The question just is, how do we put it together?
Paul DeWolf, you want to respond?
Yeah, first of all, I want to thank the caller for giving us the benefit of his experience, because I think it's a very typical experience, especially in Baltimore City. The ABLE report says that the average money bail amount in Baltimore City is $39,000. $39,000 on average, with a median income is $26,000 a year. Two-thirds of the people cannot post the bond, and that's why over 85 to 90% of the people that are in jail in Baltimore City are there for pretrial. And this hurts the most economically disadvantaged folks. And it's economically discriminatory, and it's also racially discriminatory. In Baltimore City, 60% of the population is African American. 90% of the jail population is African American. Statewide, those numbers are 30% of the population is African American. Statewide, 70% of the people in our prisons, in our jails, not our pretrial detention centers, are African American. So money bail hurts the most economically disadvantaged and communities of color.
That's okay, but I think all of you would agree. I mean, Scott Schellenberger says the system in Washington, D.C., 20 years without money bail. He thinks it's a great system. He just thinks it's way too expensive for most jurisdictions in Maryland to do. Charisse, is Scott right?
Oh, Scott's absolutely right. We could never replicate the D.C. experience in other jurisdictions, and that's predominantly because D.C. is federalized, and they also have brought in-house many of the community-based services that Scott's referring to. Those are unnecessary. Those are unnecessary to be brought inside a pretrial services component. I'd rather look at the state of Kentucky, for example. Kentucky spends, on average, about $4 per defendant to supervise them in the community. Those include the medium and sort of lower or higher risk folks that need supervision. So we can do this in Maryland. It's very simple to do this in Maryland. We have an existing infrastructure, in fact, that could easily provide supervision services, and that's our statewide probation system. So in many jurisdictions, you could take one officer from a probation department and put them in charge of overseeing the pretrial defendants. So there are very economical ways to do this. The other thing I will mention is that part of being smart on pretrial is to take a look at what supervision services are actually needed based on risk. And so for medium-risk people, we have a variety of resources to bring to bear on making them more likely to come back to court and stay out of trouble. But we have to be very cognizant of not over-supervising or over-conditioning people, because the research shows that that will produce poor outcomes. People are more likely to fail on supervision when the supervision conditions are more than what's required to help keep them attached to the court and to stay out of trouble pending trial.
Johanna has called us from Baltimore with a question about risk assessment.
Sure.
Johanna, welcome to the show.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you. Yes,
hi.
Johanna.
So my question has to do with the risk assessment and what will prevent economic and racial bias and prejudice from continuing through this risk assessment.
Thank you for the question, Johanna. Charisse, you want to address it?
Yeah, Johanna, thank you so much for that question. I know that's been very hot in the press as well about issues of racial disparity with risk assessment. So one of the great things about a risk assessment instrument is that it is these instruments, if they're validated, as Scott said, and they're specific to the jurisdiction in which we're using them, the items that are on those tools are tested for racial disparity or disparate impact. And what we know is that we can make these tools race neutral. They're also economically neutral, because when you move away from a cash-based system where I have to pay money to get out of jail, when you take that out of the equation, then what I'm basing whether or not you're risky on is the charge for which you've been arrested and items from your criminal history. And those are independent at this point of economic and race. And we know we can produce neutral outcomes with the use of those tools. The existing cash bail system is highly economically and racially divisive within the state.
John has called us from Baltimore. John, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hello, John.
Hey there, everybody. I was wanting to talk a little bit about my own experience and also to also ask about this pretrial supervision necessity. A couple of years ago, I was arrested for malicious destruction of property, value less than $500, for breaking a glass picture frame. Anyway, commissioner set the bond at $7,500. And, my wife paid a bond, the 10%, $750, which was a lot for us. That was a month's rent. And we ended up in eviction court a month later because we couldn't make the rent that month. And it was non-refundable. It was a hardship. Now, yes?
Yes.
I was just going to share that story, but I also wanted to ask, really, what is the necessity of this extensive pretrial supervision? Like having someone, get drug treatment or get drug tested or what have you. Yeah, just let them out.
John, I appreciate the question. Paul DeWolf, do you have an answer for John?
Well, I think that's where evidence-based practices comes in. If people are low risk, then I agree with him. Let them out because they'll go to court. Study shows that they show up in court at high rates, that they don't reoffend while they're awaiting court. And then they have time to prepare and to live with their family and to pay their rent and to do whatever. So that's why evidence-based practices is so important to this. to this procedure. But his experience, $7,500, that's a lot of money for his family. It's rent money. He went to eviction court as a result of that. And that story is repeated time and time again throughout our state and throughout our country. I'd just like to make one quick point on Scott and I were on the Justice Reinvestment Commission. The concept behind that is to take money, savings from the justice system and reinvest them into the community, into treatment. The ABLE report says that it costs $159 a day to keep someone in central booking, $2.50 a day to supervise them on pretrial. If someone is low risk and medium risk, they absolutely should be.
We have just a couple minutes left. Scott Schellenberger, you've said that there are some of the recommendations of this report that you are for. What would you like to see movement on first?
I think the validated risk assessment is something that we should start on right now. I think that, there are some great models that Paul has actually, I believe, visited that we could, start looking at and then start actually validating here in the state of Maryland. I think that we should really start encouraging every county to have a pretrial services unit. I think that some of them can get started pretty easily. I think Charisse is right. I know the probation department is kind of stretched pretty thin right now, and it might not sound like borrowing one person out of probation and putting them in pretrial would be a big deal, but in some of these smaller counties, it would be kind of tough. But I do think that that's something that that we could do. I don't disagree that that we could wrap some of these concepts into the new Justice Reinvestment Coordinating Council, and try to use the mileage we got with the Justice Reinvestment Act that was just passed last year, and try and wrap some of these concepts into that. Because Paul is right. We do need more mental health treatment and more drug treatment in this state. And anywhere we can find the money to open more of those up would be great.
Charisse, less than a minute left. What, in addition to everything that Scott Schellenberger just endorsed, would you want to move quickly on?
I would like to see Maryland actually join our 3 days count campaign to reduce arrests, replace the cash bail system, and restrict detention. And Scott's right, there are low-hanging fruit. I think that also the number one thing is to move immediately to the use of unsecured bonds. So if Scott really believes that skin in the game matters, then have people have that skin in the game. Just don't hold them ransom to get out of jail.
So much to think about. I'm really grateful to you all for this conversation. Paul DeWolf, Maryland's public defender, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Charisse Fennell-Burdine, executive director of the Pretrial Justice Institute. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you for having me.
And Scott Schellenberger, Baltimore County State's attorney, thank you.
Thanks for having me. I fear I'm going to be on another commission.
I'll sit next to you, Scott.
And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. Over the summer break, many students lose some of the academic skills they've mastered in the school year. What can parents do about what's been dubbed the summer slide? I'm Sheila Krast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.